Lecture 18, Obelisks.
Hi, welcome back. Remember last time we were talking about Hatshepsut? And one of her greatest achievements were the obelisks that she had quarried and erected at Karnak Temple. Today I want to talk about just what a great achievement it was, how difficult it was to quarry an obelisk, to erect it. I think that in some ways erecting an obelisk was harder than building a pyramid. But we'll let you judge. First, something about the word, a little philology. The ancient Egyptians called obelisks techenu, right? That was the ancient Egyptian word. But the Arabs, the modern Arabs, call it masala, a needle, right? That's where we get Cleopatra's needle. Sometimes obelisks are called that. But the real word, our word, obelisk, comes from the Greek. When the Greeks came into Egypt and saw these tall, pointy things, they called them obelisk, which means a meat skewer, like for shish kebab. Yeah, that's what you put meat on. That's what obelisk means in Greek. So that's where we get the word. But the origin of the obelisk, not just the word, is religious. Remember when we were talking about the early days, the Old Kingdom, and there was a point at which a stone, a tall, thin stone, was worshipped called a benben, right? We're not exactly sure what it was. This is probably the origin of the obelisk. The benben evolves into an obelisk. Obelisks were always associated with the sun, and sun temples had obelisks. And also, if you think about it, every obelisk has a pyramid on top, right? So there's a kind of nice little symbolism there. The city that had more obelisks than any other in Egypt was Heliopolis, which is Greek for sun city. Helios, sun, Opolis, city. That's the biblical own, the own of the Bible, right? Had more obelisks than any other city, but there's only one left now, only one. Let me tell you where the obelisks are, because they've moved quite a bit. Heliopolis has only one left. Now, Karnak Temple in Thebes, which grew to be the greatest temple in the history of the world, and we'll talk about that another time. Karnak Temple had a dozen. There were two that Thutmose I erected, right? He was Hatshepsut's father. Hatshepsut had four, and her nephew, Thutmose III, had six, right? But there are only two standing now in Karnak, only two. One is Hatshepsut's, and one is her nephew's, and one is her father's, Thutmose I. Only two obelisks. You know what's interesting? Hatshepsut's obelisk. You'll remember, of course, that Thutmose III, as part of an official policy to erase any trace of her name, went to Deir el-Bahari, carved her name out. Well, she had an obelisk standing in Karnak Temple that really was so big, you couldn't take it down. You know, you'd hit other buildings. So he walled it in. He built a wall all the way up, walling in Hatshepsut's obelisk. So when you go to Karnak Temple, you can see the two obelisks that are still standing. One is her father's, and then there's one that's kind of walled in pretty much. That's Hatshepsut's. You know, as I said, I think she was really most proud of the obelisks. She talked about having quarried two obelisks in 7 months, transported them on a single barge, and then erected them at Karnak Temple. On the base of her obelisk, she talks about the obelisks. And she says, I erected them for my father Amun. They could be seen from the other side of the Nile, their tips gleaming in electrum. Electrum was a mixture of gold and silver. So the tip, the pyramid part, was gold-plated, so to speak. I mean, she was really quite proud. She also, you know, Hatshepsut used her obelisk as kind of propaganda, but you also get insight. She wasn't trying to pass herself off as a man. She calls herself the female Horus, the female falcon, meaning she's the king, but she's female, right? But that's Hatshepsut's obelisks. Ramses II, a pharaoh who's coming down the road, he had more than a dozen obelisks, small ones in a city in the delta, but he also erected two huge ones at Luxor Temple. One is still standing. There's a story told by a later historian that says that when Ramses' obelisk was being erected, and by the way, we have no records of how they were erected. I'll talk about that in a minute. When Ramses' obelisk was being erected, he had one of his sons tied to the top of it so the workmen would be doubly careful in erecting the obelisk. Right? Well, he had 50 sons, so I guess if he lost one, it wasn't terrible. But anyway, Ramses had quite a few obelisks. What I'd like to talk about now is how to quarry and erect an obelisk. Right? First, what's the material? Pink granite. All obelisks come from the same quarry at Aswan. This was the major site of pink granite. We even call it Aswan granite. The reason you need granite is if you're going to do a really big obelisk, you need a stone with internal structural strength that can support its own weight. When you pivot it, you don't want it just to break, like a piece of macaroni would. If you made it too long, it would break. So it has to be granite. All the obelisks you see in Egypt are granite from the same quarry. It's hard to give you a feeling of just how big they are. There is an unfinished obelisk in the quarry at Aswan. It weighs more than 1,000 tons. It's as big as 2 jumbo jets. Incredible. No mechanical devices, you know, no hydraulic jacks to move these things. But let me tell you how they quarried it. They didn't do it with chisels. They pounded it out with a stone that's even harder than S1 granite, dolerite. Now, this was a job that nobody wanted, I'm quite sure of it. Probably used as punishment for prisoners. And what they had, say you pick the piece of stone, a stonemason comes, the expert, and he chooses a site in the quarry that looks like it's flaw-free, no flaws. You're not going to have any cracks. And he probably marks it out in a black ink where the obelisk is going to be, right? Marks it out on the wall. And then you take your prisoners and you set them to work pounding out the obelisk. They would take their dolerite ball and just keep dropping it. Boom, 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 boom. Dropping it, picking it up. It would kind of bounce off the obelisk. I've tried these things. It would bounce off the obelisk, and they would do that all day long. And we can tell by the grooves in the unfinished obelisk, you know, that these guys were like shoulder to shoulder, just pounding. And there's no question about it. You're going to get an awful lot of dust in your lungs, just breathing it in, pink granite dust. But that's how they would quarry an obelisk, just pounding and pounding. It's remarkable. There are no chisel marks on the unfinished obelisk. It's a marvel to look at. You know, I love unfinished things, as I said, because you learn more about an unfinished object than a finished one. You see how it was built. It's left in the middle. There are no chisel marks, as I say. What they must have done is after they pounded it free on a few sides, you have to free it on the bottom. You know, how do you get the thing free on the bottom? And that's where they had to dig caverns. They probably took these dolerite balls and then threw it against the thing, kept kind of horizontally dropping it against the side, chiseling out caverns. So you can imagine the miners, so to speak, the guys working on the obelisk, going into a cavern underneath the obelisk. So then you've got little caverns carved out underneath the obelisk, and then you kind of shore it up maybe on a couple of places and carve the rest out. I mean, amazing job. And Hatshepsut says she did 2 of them in 7 months, erecting them, carving them, transporting them, all in 7 months. Incredible. Now, how do you move it? They were pulled on rollers. They probably had lots of logs serving as rollers, and eventually they would get the obelisk onto a roller and with ropes roll it along. The rollers would move. Maybe you put the log in front as you're using up the logs, keep moving them in front, moving your obelisk. And they'd move it down to the side of the Nile, to the banks of the Nile. Now imagine the obelisk lying on its side, on the bank, parallel to the Nile. What they next did, and this is what an ancient historian says, we have no record of the Egyptians about how they erected obelisks. They next dug a canal under the obelisk. So imagine the obelisk is kind of like a bridge across the canal. It's going at right angles to the canal that's been dug. And you bring in a barge in this canal under the obelisk. The barge is loaded with blocks of granite, maybe equal to the obelisk in weight. And you start removing the blocks of granite from the barge. So the barge is starting to raise up underneath the obelisk, right? Till finally, you get the obelisk floating on the barge. Then you pivot it onto the barge, and you're ready for transport. Now, Hatshepsut, on her temple, if you'll remember, shows the transportation of one of the obelisks, of two of the obelisks, on one barge. They're end to end. And there were boats towing them. Now, 27 boats for Hatshepsut's two obelisks, with three pilot boats. Now, I think one of the things that makes this all possible is the granite quarry is in the south. It's in Aswan. So when you're floating the obelisk, it's going with the current. It's going north to the site, to Thebes, to the delta, wherever it's going. So it's a lot easier to move your obelisk with the current than against it. So that's how obelisks were probably transported to the site. Now, how do you erect an obelisk? You know, it bothers us a lot that the Egyptians didn't have any architectural papyri. You know, we have no record of building pyramids, how they built pyramids. Don't have any instructions how to build a temple or a tomb. How'd they erect an obelisk? A couple of theories. I'll tell you the best that I think is good. It's a ramp theory. You build a ramp right next to the site where you want the obelisk to be erected. And the ramp is really, in a sense, a double-sided ramp. You can have it going up, and then you can have it going down. And you pull your obelisk up the ramp, and then you slide it down onto its base where you want it to be erected. So the obelisk is lying on its side on a ramp. Its edge is on the base, but it's still at like maybe a 45-degree angle or something like that. It's not upright yet. Now, this is our best theory about how they erected an obelisk. It's at 45 degrees so far, on its pedestal, but it's not erect yet. What do you do next? You tie ropes to the top of the obelisk, and you have lots of guys pulling. Now remember, the Egyptians didn't use draft animals for heavy work. These are men pulling on ropes, trying to get the obelisk erect. This is a theory, but it's probably how it was done. Very recently, just a couple of years ago, there was a television special where an Egyptologist tried to actually erect an obelisk. It's a wonderful show. It's done by an archaeologist, an Egyptologist, Mark Lehner, a good man, good Egyptologist, and he's done two shows that are similar, and it's quite interesting to see him work. He's kind of an experimental archaeologist. He tries to do stuff and figure out how it was done that way, which I love. He did one show called This Old Pyramid, where he tried to build a little tiny pyramid and try and imagine how they did it. Didn't quite succeed. I mean, learned some things, very interesting. But he also did a show called, I think it's called This Old Obelisk. I think it's still like This Old Pyramid, where he tried to erect an obelisk this way. The ramp, slide it down, and then get you guys pulling on it. Now, let me emphasize. This TV show used an obelisk that is much, much smaller than an Egyptian big one. I think it was 37 tons, something like that. Much smaller. They couldn't get it up. They had 100 guys pulling on the ropes, you know, doing the Egyptian thing, huppa, the way the Egyptian workmen call, huppa. They didn't get the obelisk erect, right? Now, they had a deadline. They had a television deadline. It was a valiant attempt, but it didn't go. I don't think this means that wasn't the method, though. I think they had about 100 guys pulling on the rope. I remember looking at the TV screen, and I started counting, you know. They had about 100 guys. I think if they had a few more hundred, maybe 500, might have gotten it up. Maybe. But that obelisk lies today in the quarry where they tried to erect it. It's still there, a kind of little monument to the greatness of ancient Egypt. You know, they couldn't do it. Now, obelisks are all over the world today. And I want to talk about, to give you an idea of just how great the Egyptians were, I want to tell you about the troubles that people have had erecting obelisks in fairly recent times. It's an amazing story. And you'll see why I say that in a sense, building an obelisk or erecting an obelisk, quarrying an obelisk, was greater than building a pyramid. I mean, for example, do you know what keeps an obelisk standing on its base? Nothing but gravity. There is nothing holding it. No pins, no side clamps. It is simply balanced on the base. Amazing. But you have to be very precise. And think about some of those obelisks. They've been standing for a couple of thousand years. Haven't been knocked over. There have been some earthquakes, little tremors. Some were knocked over by earthquakes, by the way. But that's amazing. Just amazing. But let me tell you about modern attempts at moving obelisks and doing things with them. Rome was fascinated with obelisks. Rome loved obelisks. And when the Romans came to Egypt, they moved them around. Not easily, but they moved them. For example, two were moved in 10 BC by the Emperor Augustus. He moved them from Heliopolis, Sun City, to Alexandria on the Mediterranean. They stood in front of the Caesarion, a temple for Caesar. Now, those obelisks are gone now. But I'm going to tell you about their travels. But just wait 1 minute. Here's your trivia question. What city in the world has more obelisks than any other? Rome. 13. The Romans moved them through. Now, they were erected for their circus. You know, a circus, of course, just means round. And it was a racetrack where you could have racehorses going around, or chariot races. And in the center, it was neat to have an obelisk. Right? So they went around the obelisk. Now, as time went on, after the Romans erected them, the obelisks fell. Many of them fell and were lost. Underground, got muddy, they disappeared. But in the 16th century, there was a kind of Egyptomania. Everybody got interested in Egypt again. And they went around with iron bars, poking in the ground where the circuses had been, trying to find the obelisks. And they found some. And they started re-erecting them. And it wasn't easy, believe me. It was not easy. They had a contest where they had architects designing ways to raise the obelisk. And one of the ways they finally used was winches. But they weren't pulled by horses or draft animals. They were pulled by men because they wanted to be able to control the ropes very finely. They were afraid a horse might move, might get scared. So men were pulling winches, trying to get the obelisks up. And they succeeded. Right? Now, Paris has an obelisk. All of you have taken French know it's the Obelisk de Luxor. Right? It's from Luxor Temple. It's one of Ramses the Great's obelisks. It was moved in the 1830s. And it's a wonderful story. Muhammad Ali Pasha was the ruler of Egypt then. And he gave to France, as a goodwill gesture, he wanted to get in the good on good side of France, he gave them two obelisks at Alexandria, the two at Alexandria that had been moved by Augustus. Now, when Champollion went to Egypt, he looked at the obelisks and he told the French government, get one at Luxor, it's better. And he said, if you can get one, get the one on the left, it doesn't have a crack. Right? So Paris got the Obelisk de Luxor because Champollion, the decipher of hieroglyphs, said, take that one. That was first erected in the 1830s, right, at the Place de la Concorde, where it is today. Right? The next obelisk, though, caused tremendous problems. This was London's obelisk. London got their obelisk in 1877. It's one of the ones at Alexandria, given to the British government, right? A gift of Egypt. There were two at Alexandria, as I said, but one fell down from an earthquake in 1301. One was upright. So the French had a tougher time, in a sense, than the British. The French took an obelisk that was upright. The British at Alexandria said, we'll take the one that's on the ground. They didn't have to lower it, right? Now, how did they move it? Their engineer was a guy named Wayman Dixon, a good man. And he designed a caisson looking very much like a giant cigar tube, like what cigars come in. And they put the obelisk inside this cigar tube, this caisson, and they towed it all the way. Now, there were problems. A storm came up, and the obelisk broke free, and six men died, right, moving the obelisk to London. The obelisk was lost at sea. Now, I don't mean it sank, but it was lost. And a day later, another ship found it and claimed it. Now, they claimed that by rights of the sea, it was theirs. And they wanted an outrageous price from the British government. And finally, you know, they did a reasonable negotiation. The British government said, well, keep it. You know, what are they going to do with an obelisk? So finally, they paid a fee for the recovery, and it was erected on the Thames. So if you want to see the obelisk from Alexandria, the one that was lying down, you can see it on the banks of the Thames. Now, that's one of the Alexandria obelisks. As soon as London got its obelisk, New York felt, we need one, we need one, we need one. Right? So New York had to have one. Now, the New York obelisk was moved in 1880. And let me tell you, if I could ever direct a feature movie, it would be about the moving of the obelisk to New York. It's an incredible story. It was moved in 1880 by a naval lieutenant, Gorringe was his name, and he is my hero. Gorringe had more problems put in his way, more implement, and he overcame them all. He was paid by William Vanderbilt. Vanderbilt wanted New York to have an obelisk, and they were going to have an obelisk. Now, the obelisk was on land. That part of Alexandria was owned by an Italian. And the Italian said, if you're going to take the obelisk from my land, you have to pay me. Now, the Italian before had been suing the government to get the obelisk off his land, right? But anyway, Gorringe worked it out. But the problem was, Egypt was bankrupt at this time. And Egypt was being run by loads of foreign consortiums. The post office was run by the Italians, the antiquity service was run by the French, and the streets of Alexandria were owned by the merchants. And they said to Gorringe, you can't take it through the streets of Alexandria to the port. You can't do that. They said, it's going to damage our sewer system. They really just wanted a big bribe, and Gorringe never gave in. What Gorringe did, he had it hauled right out to the Mediterranean at Alexandria and floated around to the port, right? Floated it around. Gorringe was a great guy. He not only took the obelisk, he took the pedestal, which had weighed 50 tons. Now, when he came to get the obelisk, though, there was a real problem for him. He had to lower it, and there wasn't really enough timber. There wasn't enough timber available in Egypt to lower the obelisk. Just an amazing problem. He tried to build a scaffolding, which he eventually did, around the obelisk, not all the way up. But then he couldn't move the obelisk. You know why? When the Romans had moved it, they chipped the base, the corners of, not the base of the obelisk, but the base of the obelisk itself, not the pedestal. Chipped the corners. And when they re-erected it, they had to kind of shore it up. So they created bronze crabs, four bronze crabs, one on each corner, pinning the obelisk in. And it was kind of holding the obelisk on its base. Gorringe had to remove the crabs. And he eventually used hydraulic jacks to kind of lift it up and pivot it. And as he pivoted the obelisk, as it was parallel to the ground, it started crashing through the timbers. The timbers finally stopped it, but it was a very, very tense moment. Finally, he got it down, floated it around to the port, and started the long journey. Now, he obtained a boat. Fortunately for Gorringe, fortunately, the postal service of Egypt was bankrupt, so he could buy a postal steamer rather easily and rather cheaply. And he bought a steamer called the Dusug. He opened up the hull of the Dusug, actually opened the thing up, and inside, he shoved the obelisk, rolling it on cannonballs, right, to get it inside the ship, then had the hull closed, and had to sail to New York. Now, when I say had to sail to New York, he had two problems. He couldn't get legal registration for the ship. And he's a naval commander, used to registration, papers. He just took off. The other problem was his crew. There was no crew in Egypt that could sail this thing. He had to get the original crew, who were Yugoslav, and he got them from Yugoslavia and sailed off to New York without any papers. He soon found out that the crew was alcoholic, and there was a really rough voyage. I mean, just about the whole crew. But he finally made it to New York. But his problems weren't over. He brings it around to Staten Island and finally to the East River, the east side of Manhattan. Manhattan, remember, has water on both sides, East River, and it's got the Hudson River on the west. The people who own the ports on the east side want to charge him an exorbitant fee. He refuses. He will not pay an exorbitant fee to unload the obelisk. He sails around Manhattan, right, and lands it on 96th Street. But there's a slight problem here. There's a railroad track that he has to cross to get it into Manhattan. There's a railroad track that runs along the Hudson at that time. Fortunately, Vanderbilt, who wanted the obelisk in New York and is paying him, owned the railroad. But he only had 2 hours. They were allowed to give him some lack. He had 2 hours to get it across the railroad tracks, which he did. and it's now safely in New York, but it has to be transported to its site, Central Park. Right? Now, the obelisk moved at the rate of one city block per day. Right? It was pulled along by a steam engine. What was done? They took a steam engine, an anchor chain, attached it to the obelisk, and the steam engine winched the obelisk along. At some points, they had to build railroad trestles because, you know, you have to get it uphills and downhills, and they actually built railroad trestles so that the obelisk could move like a little train being winched along at the pace of one city block per day. I wish I were a kid in New York then. It must have been incredible to go to New York. Let's watch the obelisk. I mean, you could just imagine people doing it. So Gorringe is getting this obelisk slowly but surely to New York. Sometimes it took a day just to turn a corner. I mean, you're dealing with a huge block. Right? So anyway, he finally gets the obelisk to Central Park. And by the way, there are an awful lot of firsts connected with this obelisk. For example, the pedestal, which weighed 50 tons by itself, which he brought with him, right? Brought everything. The pedestal was the largest object ever moved on wheels up until that point. It was pulled by horses, right? On this huge carriage, but it was on wheels, right? Largest ever moved, 50 tons. And there's kind of funny politics involved also. When Gorringe removed the obelisk from the pedestal in Egypt, in Alexandria, they found mason's equipment. They found a plumb bob and a trowel. And the modern Masonic order said, this is a mason's monument. The obelisk really was built by masons, erected by masons. And they kind of adopted the obelisk, right, as kind of their emblem. It's kind of nice, actually. So finally, on January 22nd, 1881, it was freezing. Gorringe is going to erect the obelisk. Now, let me tell you a secret that Gorringe didn't tell everybody. At about 2 in the morning, when nobody's in Central Park, Gorringe went and tried out the system of erecting the obelisk. He wanted to make sure it worked, you know, before everybody got there. And it was a means of hydraulic jacks lifting it, pivoting it on the base, setting it, and then putting the brass grabs back in place. So there was a huge turnout. At the erecting of the obelisk, there were 9,000 masons present. 9,000. They made great speeches. They talked about it as a Masonic monument. But the obelisk was erected. Let me say this, by the way. Gorringe had copies of the bronze crabs made so that it would still be held up in place. He had to destroy them pretty much when he got the thing out. But he did put bronze crabs at the corners, right? And in the base now of this obelisk, and you know, you should all go to see it at Central Park when you're in New York. Everybody should see the obelisk. It's right behind the Metropolitan Museum of Art. You can do a wonderful tour of the Egyptian wing, and then just go out back, and there's the obelisk on a kind of nice knoll. It's called Greywack Knoll. Very nice location. It's got an inscription that tells you what the obelisk says. And it talks about, you know, and you can see the bronze crabs. But, you know, Gorringe had to destroy the crabs, as I said, when he removed the obelisk. But the crabs are almost unmarked. They're in the back of the Egyptian section of the Metropolitan Museum of Art. I've never seen anybody look at them. They're in a glass case, but they're real history. And there are a few of the crabs, and they have inscriptions in Latin talking about how the Emperor Augustus had this obelisk moved to Alexandria. I mean, they're really a wonderful bit of history. Now, in the pedestal, as I said, other objects were placed. For example, proof coins for 1880, right? The first available proof coins for when they were going to do this. But there's one other thing that I kind of like. I'll quote to you what it says. Gorringe wrote a wonderful book about it, by the way, his adventures. And in the pedestal was placed a small box, contents known only to Mr. William Henry Hurlbut were placed. That's all. So we don't know what was in the box, but there's some mysterious box in the pedestal of the obelisk in Central Park. But I think obelisks are just as great an achievement as the raising of the pyramids in a different way. Thank you.